I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Stuff that dreams are made of.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
One morning, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got in my pajamas, I don't know.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Hello and welcome to Front Row Classics, a production of the Front Row Network of Shows, where we take a look at some of the greatest films ever made. And here's your host, Brandon Davis.
And hello to everybody out there in podcast land. This is the Front Row Network with NPR Illinois Community Voices. I'm your host, Brandon Davis, with Front Row Classics. And we are still in our continuation of Noirvember here on Front Row Classics. And Eric and I had a great conversation last week with Eddie Muller. You can hear that conversation on both our audio feeds and on YouTube. And Eric's joining me once again. How's it going, Eric?
It's going well, Brandon. How are you?
Good, good. That was a great episode we did last week.
I enjoyed it. Eddie Muller was great to us. I am not hugely knowledgeable about noir and have always wanted to see more noir movies. Mm-hmm. So he gave us some great films to go check out, and I'm excited to do that. If I get a little time here over the holidays, I'm going to check out as many of those as I can.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, we are talking about a movie that a lot of people consider the definitive noir. I checked on what Eddie says about this movie, and he does not consider this the definitive noir.
But, oh, interesting. I didn't know that. We'll get into that. That's great.
Yeah, we'll get into that. But we are talking about Howard Hawks' The Big Sleep from 1946, a landmark, entertaining, great movie. And we also have joining us for the first time in a couple months, Allison Means. Hey, Allison.
Hello.
How's it going?
It's good. It's good.
Awesome. But we've got a great, great title here to discuss, and we're going to get right into it. But Eric, before we get started, do you want to give everybody just a plot synopsis of The Big Sleep with caution?
Yeah, I'm going to do my best. So the issue with this is that it's a it's based on the Chandler book, and it's there are a lot of plot twists, and what you think's going on from 1 minute changes a lot. So we kind of have to attack this delicately. I'm going to do my best. Allison and Brandon, you feel free to jump in here because there's a lot going on in this plot. And even having seen this, this is my second time, I think, seeing this movie, there's still pieces that I'm a little gray on, but
I watched it twice for this podcast, and I'm still confused on a few things.
Okay. Good. Yeah. Okay.
It's dense.
It is
dense and twisty,
but it's in a good way too. Mm-hmm. It's not one of those movies where you walk away from it thinking, boy, I wish I understood more of what went on. And we'll talk about why that works here. But basically what you got is Humphrey Bogart as private detective Philip Marlowe. And that name's important too, because Humphrey Bogart wasn't the only actor to play that character. So this is a Philip Marlowe story. And there's been several of those produced over time, but Philip Marlowe, private detective, gets hired to go to General Sternwood's home. And General Sternwood, who we see really just in the second or third scene of the movie there, kind of gets our plot in motion. And it involves a blackmail attempt that General Sternwood asks Philip Marlowe to investigate. And you come to find out that General Sternwood's got two daughters, one, the younger daughter, who is unmarried, and we come to find out later is maybe more on the promiscuous side and has addiction, drug issues as well. And then an older daughter who is involved in some way with the younger daughter's activities, and has sort of been estranged from her original husband. And Philip Marlowe's asked to investigate this blackmail attempt, but we also find out that the older daughter's sort of paramour has gone missing as well, and we're off and running. And the blackmail attempt is coming from Mr. Geiger. So first thing that Marlowe does is go to investigate Mr. Geiger's bookstore, and then eventually ends up at his home, where he witnesses or hears from outside the home a gunshot and two characters racing off into the night in their cars. So we later find out that there's been a murder at Mr. Geiger's home. And when he goes, when Philip Marlowe goes into the home, he finds the younger daughter in there, completely inebriated, and had her picture taken in a compromising way too. This is the first like 20 minutes of the movie, by the way.
Yeah, you're not far into it.
No, no. And so it gets more complicated. Yeah. He interacts with the older daughter. We find out that she's involved in these blackmail attempts. She's also sort of involved with a well-known gambler who runs a casino. And that individual actually owned the home that Geiger was renting. And that sort of becomes the villain of the second act of the film. So that character, Eddie Mars, we interact with throughout the second half of the film. And eventually what happens, though, is Marlowe kind of puts the pieces together and discovers what's behind our blackmail attempt. Along the way, sort of falls in love with the older daughter character of Vivian Sternwood. And it sort of resolves itself there, and I'm sure we'll get into specific scenes where those actions take place. So there's my very sloppy and poor rundown of the plot of The Big Sleep.
Yeah. And I'm going to insert here real quick, just some behind the scenes stuff ahead of time, just so, because it needs to be made clear. And this just gives you an example of the kind of plot we're dealing with. Howard Hawks, the director of this movie, telegrammed Raymond Chandler, who wrote the novel in which this movie is based on, and he said, Ray, who killed Owen Taylor, the chauffeur? And Raymond Chandler just sent him a telegram back with two words: no idea.
I didn't even mention the chauffeur. No. So the chauffeur works for General Sternwood. So. We don't even see that in the movie. But this is the great part of noir, is there's a murder that happens. We never see it, but the consequences of that reach throughout the entirety of the film.
So that little bit of information gave Howard Hawks the freedom to say, hey, if the author does not know the exact details of the crime, the audience won't care either. So this is all about the journey that you go on, and it's all about the witty dialogue and the interaction between the characters and the just the process of solving a crime and following Marlowe. And this movie has got a long, sordid history, which we'll go through here in a little bit. But I want to get your guys' first impressions. Allison, we'll start with you.
So incredibly, is this the first time I've seen this? Usually, like, I love noir, and I don't know, I just missed this one. And it's riveting, but it's also so confusing. The whole time, you're like, hold on. Who's that person? Wait, huh? You're like just trying, you're trying to put the pieces together. You feel like a detective, too.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to figure out what on earth is happening in this movie while they're trying to figure out what on earth is happening in the world of the movie. So it's very, very interesting and so witty. Like there are so many, they do a really good job of like breaking the tension for you with humor. It's quick and it's really engaging in that, you know, patter dialogue kind of way that keeps you like tuned in even if you're lost plot wise.
Yeah, Eric?
So for a 2-hour movie, there's not a ton of 2-hour detective movie with murders. There's not a ton of action in this movie. You've got double entendre all over the place too. And the flirtatiousness and the sexuality just kind of oozes out of this film in a way that is amazing. And Brandon, I think you described it really well as it's the journey that you're taking. Mm-hmm. You don't really even care if the mysteries are solved at the end. You just want to see what's happening to this main character, this Philip Marlowe, throughout the film. And that is what really makes it truly enjoyably watchable. My guess is too, when you get a Raymond Chandler novel and you read through it, it had to have been a question of how do we turn this into a movie? This thing kind of seems unfilmable. And that's one of the things I loved about this, though, is that the impression of it, my first impression of it was, wow, they did a really good job of that. They, as long as you go into this assuming every character is lying, you won't be disappointed.
Yes.
Because the way they unfold the plot, peel it like an onion, is really, really fun to watch.
What this movie's what makes this movie special, though, I think at the foremost thought is Bogart and Bacall together. This is the second movie that they made together of the four, and there's just something about them that sparked when they got on screen together. It's just like, you know, it was electrical combustion. You know, it was just magical. And of course it was magical in real life as well, which was, you know, this was a rough time for Bogart because his marriage at the time was crumbling. It was a very bad marriage, turned up some days, did not turn up, was drinking a lot at that time, and yet the working relationship between him and Bacall, who was quite a bit younger than he was what sort of kept him going. And of course it ended up being, you know, one of the definitive Hollywood couples that we can think about. But let's start with Bogart, though. As you mentioned in your plot synopsis, Eric, this is, you know, he's one of many actors to play Philip Marlowe. Dick Powell played Philip Marlowe. Robert Mitchum played Philip Marlowe. A lot of great people did, and everybody brought a certain sort of uniqueness to the role. And of course, Bogart, having played another famous detective, Sam Spade, makes the character Marlowe a little Spade-ish, whereas, you know, Spade is very, Spade is more of a seedier detective, whereas in Chandler's world, Marlowe is much more unflappable. He's not as corruptible as Spade is, and yet Bogart brings that to the role. But, you know, he does it so well, and he made that kind of character into sort of a work of art that you don't even complain about it, because everything that he's riveting. And I don't care what movie he's in. If the movie's bad, Bogart's always good. And he brings a world weariness and just a, you can't get him down. He's always going to be on top of everything. And, you know, I think he's just perfect for this role, and he just thrives in this kind of part. Eric?
He definitely thrives in this kind of part, but it's really strange because when we see him as Sam Spade, he's very similar, but when we see him in The African Queen or The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, he's very different.
Oh, totally.
So this may be Bogart, but it's also a different Bogart than we get in a lot of other films. Mm-hmm. He's a lot similar to how you see him in Casablanca, but he's got that thing that he can do that not many people can, where he can say so much with saying so little. And it's not even like he's mugging for the camera. It's that, you know, his brain is processing everything that is going on around him. And it's really an understated performance. One of my favorite from him, though.
Yeah. Allison.
Oh, yeah. It's so nuanced. Like, it's so subtle and nuanced, and just like the tiny things that he puts into it, you know, the rubbing his earlobe when he's thinking, just the watching those very real kind of quirks that people have without playing it up. Because that is a trap that people fall into a lot when they're like, oh, this person plays with their ring on their hand. And then they're like trying to play with their ring in every three scenes, you know, or they try to make it a big thing. It's never mentioned. He just does it. Just quietly, slowly, without calling attention to it, he's just thinking and touching the earlobe. You know, it's things like that where you're like, this is a character that has been really fleshed out. Like, he has spent a lot of time getting into the world of this character, in this character's head. And it shows, because it's every little interaction feels purposeful.
Yeah.
You know, nothing's thrown away. Nothing's played up. It's all measured in a way that a detective in this world that they've created would have to be. And I like that you said it is a little Sam Spade-ish, but it is, I think it has more in common with Casablanca than Sam Spade. Mm-hmm. Like, in that more realism sort of way than the over-the-topness of Sam Spade and noir in general.
I like what you said there, too. Yeah, and you know, one of the things that I relate this character to the character in Casablanca is they've got their own morality. They've got their own moral code, I should say.
Yeah, they have a code.
They do. Sure. And it's not necessarily black and white, and it's, you know, he's got an agenda in this movie, and what I love is the subtlety of how he trades information. And that's just that is part of the really well-written script. But the way that Bogart plays it too, where, you know, when he's asking a question or interacting with a character, he's almost trying to position himself, jockey himself to walk away from that with something new, with some new piece of information that takes him further in the case. It's just really well played.
Yeah. What I love about Bogart, you know, in this movie and any movie is he came, you know, that sort of whole generation of actors, even the greatest actors had a tendency sometimes to get a little hammy. And I don't think Bogart ever does. Bogart is always, you know, in the moment. I think he's a great screen actor because he knows how to use the camera. Like you said, it's just through little things. You know, he can draw you in very, very closely. And what got me this time around watching it was every woman in this movie except Eddie Marr's wife throws themselves at him that he comes in contact with. And he doesn't break a sweat anytime, you know, except maybe with Bacall toward the end. But like,
even then, it's played awfully cool, then.
Yeah, but, you know, Carmen throws herself at him. The two librarians throw themselves at him. The lady cab driver throws himself at him. Mm-hmm. So it's just, but, you know, it's just, you know, hey, I'm Philip Marlowe. It's what happens to me. So
just trying to do my job.
Yeah, it's, oh, man, it's so great. And, you know, and Bogart was not – he wasn't your typical good-looking leading man. He wasn't a Cary Grant or a Clark Gable or everything, but he just – he had this charisma about him that I think just drew people in, and it was just fantastic. And then add in, of course, Lauren Bacall to the mix, and I still – when I watched A Have and Have Not in this, to have someone who had never acted before – who was a 19 when she did The Have and Have Not, 20 when she did this. It's amazing. I mean, but she learned from the best, Howard Hawks and Bogart. And I think her character, her portrayal of Vivian in this is so cool and so measured and so great. And she's even more, you know, just uncaring as he is, and that's what I love about him.
Yeah,
I think more than any other leading lady, he met his match in her, Allison.
Yeah, I think, you know, I said he played it cool, but she was cold, like downright cold through a lot of it, which is nice as a contrast to all those other women throwing themselves.
Yeah.
And you could see how it makes you go, aha, I see how this would, you know, spark his interest. Like, this is different. This is what's happening here. That is engaging because they're on the same level, like intellectually, which you get to see when they go back and forth. The whole scene with the calling the police, I was cracking up through that whole thing. Like, oh, you have to tell my father. Oh, tell my mother. That was delightful. Yeah. And I was, that was one of your first moments where you're going, oh, they really are, you know, well matched in this way. She's not going to stand down. She's here to defend her family, to make sure things aren't uncovered that shouldn't be. And she's going to do what she has to do. Mm-hmm. And that makes the romance kind of secondary and incidental, which works because it's not that, like, oh, poor me, my, you know, that like noir stereotype of the grieving widow who's not really grieving at all, and you know, kind of seductive in a way that this, it doesn't feel purposefully seductive. Mm-hmm. It feels more real, which, you know, it has the actual rooted realness of their real romantic relationship. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. That was pretty fraught at this point with him still being married. And I think that plays in here because there's stakes that transfer onto the on-screen relationship. And that was really, when you read all of that and you kind of place it in the timeline of their lives, it's interesting to watch how that plays out on screen between these two fictional characters. Mm-hmm. That it was really fascinating and enjoyable to watch.
Yeah. Eric.
Yeah. I love this performance by Lauren Bacall, and Allison, I agree that there's a whole backstory that Lauren Bacall is dealing with. You can see it kind of mm-hmm. being processed the entire time that she's on screen and she's not giving it to you. That holding back is a difficult thing, I think, for any actor to do. And then I love that the script gives them, Bogey and Bacall, a scene where they take all that pretense. We see him flirtatious with all of these other women who are like Brandon said, kind of throwing themselves at her. And then later on, she says a line, something to the effect of, sugar doesn't work on me. And he says, it doesn't work on him either. Yeah. And then the pretense is gone. And the next time we see them, they are on even ground, and they are just, they're like two fencers just circling each other, trying to figure out where the other one is at that moment in time. And it's beautiful. And the movie works the best when it's the two of them trading that repartee.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. I love everything about, just how you mentioned, Eric, he finally does find his equal, and they're almost like partners, even though they're unwilling to admit it to each other throughout this whole thing.
They've got completely different agendas at that point too. In fact, she tries to screw him over.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
couple of times.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And it really is astounding. You know, it's hard to talk about this movie, you know, on screen with, you know, not with alongside what was happening off screen. But, you know, just the fact that these two, you know, did find each other at this right time. And I think that she kind of provided him a little bit of hope, you know, the fact that, you know, his life wasn't over and that he could find happiness again. And all of that, there's just a sense of fun, I think, in their banter back and forth. And I think Bacall was even quoted as saying, because Howard Hawks at this time had so much power, and he was such an independent producer director that Jack Warner literally had like no say in what was going on in this movie. And apparently, Jack Warner sent a telegram down to the stage one day and said, "I heard about all the fun going down here on this set. This must stop." So yeah, that was and that whole sense of fun goes all the way through this movie. But I want to talk about, I you know, there there's a big supporting cast in this movie, and I don't think we have time to go through all of them, but I think we can highlight, you know, a couple. You know, the next one being Martha Vickers, who plays Carmen, who was, like Bacall, another model turned actress, and really makes her mark on this movie too, and I think steals some scenes out from even Bogart and Bacall in the little bit of screen time that she has. Allison?
Yeah, I thought, you know, that is a tough part, you know, to portray someone with significant, like, substance abuse problems, with a kind of sordid, checkered history throughout that is not especially good as a person, but to still play that part in a way that is, you empathize with the character who, but like I said, it's not necessarily a good person. Probably not a good person at all. And you know that going in because it's established for you immediately, that generally we're not dealing with good people here.
Right.
And for her to, as, you know, a very young actress and relatively new at this point too, I think she does it exceptionally well. Because again, the throwing yourself at people thing can be played too big. And that's a fine line because it does have to be a little big on purpose because otherwise it's not throwing yourself at people. But to do it in a way that's not super annoying and off-putting is hard. I think it's done really successfully.
Yeah, and the thing about her character is everything that surrounds her character is stuff that couldn't be readily talked about in 1946.
Right, because of Hays Code.
Whether it be substance abuse, and then Geiger is clearly running a pornography ring, but you couldn't say that in 46. So everything that she does is basically subtext.
And
I think she does it really well. Eric?
Yeah,
I agree. And I love that Allison brought that up, that the very first scene, we kind of see who this character is. And you know, Bogie and Bacall obviously have chemistry, but to be able to pull off what they did there too, where she sort of makes him catch her, she's literally throwing herself.
Quite literally.
Yeah. And it works very, very well. And she definitely is an electrifying presence whenever she is on the screen. But like Allison said, not in this annoying way. You realize that she's a victim as well, and you have sympathy for her. When, and a lot of times a character like that, you might say, and you said she's a good person, but somehow we gain sympathy for this character, and I think it's because of the performance. I think it was really well done.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of times, especially post-Code, women who are overtly sexual are villains. And so it's interesting to see in this time period that she is not played as a villain, that she's not, you know, rewritten to be that. And that they don't remove her humanity, from her in that way. And I appreciated that.
Because even at the end, Bogart, you know, tells Bacall, you know, you need to put her somewhere where they can possibly cure her.
Right.
So it's not treated as it's totally her fault either. So that's what's great about that too. Another character I want to get to, let's talk, I guess he's one of the main villains of the piece, Eddie Mars, who's played by John Ridgely, someone who has never, you know, who never made it huge as an actor, but always played these kinds of parts. And I think he does it well because when you first meet him, there's nothing really consequential about him. But then, you know, as time moves on, you know, you see the villainy come out a little bit more, and he has, of course, a great, you know, death in the film, a very dramatic death in the film.
Yes.
That's great. But yeah, Eric, do you have any comments about him as Eddie Mars?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's talked about a lot, but we really don't see John Ridgely on screen a ton. But when we do, he does he does sort of have an ominous presence about him, which is played really well. So I'm not sure that I could say much more about him than that. He's there for that purpose, and he does it really well.
Yeah. Yes. Somebody who I do want to give credit to, though, because she does not get credit in the credits.
Poor Agnes.
Is Sonia Darren, who plays Agnes, gets a ton of screen time, causes a lot of stuff to happen in the movie, but Sonia Darren just had a lousy agent.
She was not credited, right?
No,
I mean, she credit.
Didn't get credit. And apparently it's because her agent, I forget, said something very insulting to Jack Warner and a lot of the heads at Warner Brothers. And, you know, the way they got him back was not giving his client screen credit. And of course, it ended up hurting her worse than it hurt him, because she was done acting by 4 years later in 1950. Mm. So this could have been like a breakout role for her, but nobody knew
her name. She's great.
Nobody knew her name. Yeah. Yeah, she's really, really good, and she gets more screen time than Martha Vickers, and she really, really makes a lot of stuff happen, and you feel for her at certain times, and she's great. One of my favorite scenes, definitely, and we'll talk about later, is when, you know, Bogart pretends to be the book nerd, and she's great in that. She's great in that back and forth with him. But yeah, I guess I wanted to give credit to her where credit was due.
Yeah. I agree with you both. I think she does a wonderful job in this, and she's actually got a huge range of emotion that she gets to play in this too, and does a good job with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really a big role to not get credited. It's wildly unfair to this poor woman.
Yeah, it is. It is insane. And then also, I think Charles Waldron as General Sternwood is very good. He only gets one scene in the movie at the very beginning, but his scene with Bogart's very good, and he has a great presence. And of course, it sets the tone for the rest of the film. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but let's go to favorite scenes. And then this movie, I read here Howard Hawks, the director of this film, who we haven't talked about a Howard Hawks film yet on Classics, but he directed a boatload. He directed Bringing Up Baby, His Girl Friday, Red River, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, Rio Bravo, and he's always known for fast-talking dialogue in movies, and this is one of the best examples of that. He keeps the pace moving, and he is famous as having said, a great movie is a movie with three great scenes and no bad scenes. And so I think this movie fits that criteria, because there's way more than three great scenes in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
So let's start with you, Eric. What's one of your favorite scenes?
I think that I had never heard that quote before, but no bad scenes probably fits The Big Sleep really, really well. So it's tough to pick out the ones that are most exceptional. And you've got a very fast-paced movie. So when you look at the scenes, some of them kind of are even quick little scenes, but they're all very well done. You know, probably one of my favorite scenes, though, is when you get Bogey and Bacall in the bar restaurant together, and they have that moment where they break all the pretenses down. And it's them just going at it verbally with each other. And the thing I love about it is you can tell that they go from flirtatious to hating each other, to loving each other, to wanting to jump into bed with each other, all in that scene, and it's 2 minutes long. I mean, it is just them at their best, in my opinion.
Very suggestive dialogue.
Extremely.
which that dialogue was written by.
What's great is that we're post-code here. They can't go right out and say a lot of the things that they want to.
Yeah.
So they kind of dance around it, and it works really, really well.
Yeah, and that dialogue was written by, and it always takes me aback when I see his name on the screenplay list, but William Faulkner. One of the great novelists of the 20th century was a screenwriter on this movie. It's always like every time I see a movie from the 30s and see F. Scott Fitzgerald as a screenwriter too, it always takes me back.
Like, this is weird.
Yeah, so you had real literary people writing these movies. Mm-hmm. And what's kind of crazy to me is, why didn't you get Raymond Chandler to write the screenplay? But he, because he wrote the screenplay for Double Indemnity, so I figured maybe he would do for this, but he had no idea who killed the chauffeur, so I guess that's why. Yeah.
Maybe that's there is what lost him the gig.
Yeah.
There is a big difference between being a great novelist and a good screenwriter too.
Yeah.
So who knows? Maybe Raymond Chandler couldn't figure out how to put this together in a way that would make a great movie. Mm-hmm. Plus when you write it, he probably would have been resistant to some of the changes maybe that right. they would have had to make to be able to yeah. film this movie.
Yeah. Cause Double Indemnity wasn't his novel. He was adapting it from another source. So I guess that's
right.
That's probably yeah. why as well. Yeah.
I could see it. Yeah, it's easy to be a little too precious about your own work.
Mm-hmm. Especially something like this, which is yeah. really complex and probably spent a lot of time figuring out the plot and the characters. Actually, I think he assembled this from several of his other works, right? From several short stories that he yeah. had written.
Yeah. Yeah. Allison, do you have a favorite scene?
I have a couple of favorites. Sure. I mentioned earlier that telephone interplay. That's the repartee that I crave, like that kind of stuff. I absolutely love it. That just gives you the idea of like, okay, they are on an intellectual, you know, on the same intellectual level. And I enjoyed that. It was funny. It did move the plot along. It wasn't, you know, just out there to be funny for no reason. And you get to see the two of them just back and forth at each other in the ways that, like Eric, you said before, that the moments where this movie works best is when it's just Bogey and Bacall. The easiness between them makes it work.
Yeah.
And then in the scene in the car when they're leaving Canino before they, you know, at the end there, I absolutely love that with the whole, like, I guess I love you. Yeah. You just understated.
I love that because they don't love each other, and yet those words mean they love each other, and at the same time, they do love each other, and it's just yeah. like there's all of that going on there with just that line, I guess I love you. It's amazing.
I know. Oh, it's so good, and it's so well played. You know, there's no dramatic, like, kiss. There's just an arm, just a hand on a shoulder.
Yeah.
Where she's like slouched down and hidden, and he's just trying to get them where they need to go safely. And they're moving from one dangerous position to another dangerous position. And you don't you don't get the dramatic over the top, like, we may not make it out alive. Like, it's just, I guess, well, why did you do this? Well, I guess I love you.
Yeah.
And that's where you get all of that, you know, discussion about what to do with the sister and where Bogey puts together what happened to Sean Regan. It all kind of starts to click there. Everything starts to make sense. And I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, Sean Regan, I'm like, by the end of the movie, I feel like I know what he looks like. He's talked about so much.
Right,
for a person who never appears.
Yeah, and I love, and they never really give you a whole lot of detail about what his role was with the Sternwoods. You just know that General Sternwood paid him to do his drinking for him. Yeah, that's all that you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, I love the mystery surrounding that. But what I love is all the small characters that get just little moments. Like I love Norris the butler because he's just willing to cover for anybody. I love that, but the scene that always sticks out to me is after Marlo realizes something fishy is going on over at Geiger's. He goes to the bookstore across the street to double check the facts, and he meets up with the librarian played by Dorothy Malone, who was very unknown at the time, but would go on into the 50s to be a very famous actress, would win an Oscar for the movie Written on the Wind. Very good, but she caused such a sensation in this movie because I don't think anyone had ever seen a librarian in heat before, I guess. but it's she has great chemistry with Bogart, and she does. And just she takes advantage of that one scene she's given, and apparently the screenwriters, you know, that's just a little throwaway scene in the book, but because of the way the two of them were playing it, they really spell it out, make it like they do have a little, you know, afternoon, you know, dalliance, you know, to wait out the rain. and it's played great.
It is. Yeah. When he asks her if she needs her glasses, though, what a 1940s thing to be like, you know, you'd be a lot more attractive without your glasses.
Right. But yeah, guys don't make passes at girls who wear glasses.
Right.
Thanks, Dorothy Parker.
But she is, she's great. And then I also love, I mentioned before, the scene between Agnes and Marlo at the beginning when he's pretending to be the bookner, because that's just not a kind of persona you ever see Bogart take on in any other movie. And to see him with the hat up like that, and the way that he does his little bit with the glasses, and, you know, the way he says, it's fantastic. Yeah. It's fantastic. And, and this is why, and I mentioned it before, this is why Eddie Muller says that while it has so much greatness about film noir to it, he said that he almost feels like it's almost more of a fast-paced comedy with film noir elements. And so that's why he doesn't put it in his top tier of film noir, which I can see it. But yeah, it's so entertaining. And it's also cool to hear Lauren Bacall sing. And for years... For years, it was a rumor that she had that people were dubbing for her and everything, but both Hawks and her confirmed that that was her own voice. And of course, in the 70s, she would later do Broadway musicals and stuff, but in the movie, she never sang again after that.
And she sounds great. And that's a fun scene in the casino as well, where you know something's going on, but you're not really sure. And it leads to one of those more suspenseful moments of the movie, which I really like in this too. The way that it's shot and the lighting that you've got, when Bogart's out in the parking lot waiting for her to come out, it kind of moves you to the edge of your seat. And you get that too with the scene with Canino and Harry Jones.
Poor Harry Jones.
Poor Harry Jones.
But Elisha Cook Jr.
Yeah, a really suspenseful scene there as well. So there's a lot of those great moments in this movie too.
Yeah, I love that scene because it's Elisha Cook Jr. who played Wilmer in The Maltese Falcon. And so he always plays these poor guys who gets thrown under the bus. But yeah, you can tell the son, you know, he's really in love with Agnes. And that's but yeah, and then the poor guy gets poisoned. But
poisoned. After he goes, it's not poison, and then that's why he laughs. I was like, why is he laughing? And then I'm like, oh, no, it was. I would probably laugh too.
One of my other favorite scenes of this movie, though, is when you get a lot of the main characters together in the same room. So you get Philip Marlowe, you get Vivian, and I'm trying to remember who all shows up, but Agnes, who's then with Joe Brody, correct? They show up at the it's a hotel room maybe that they're in. I'm not even sure exactly where they are.
Or his apartment.
I think it's an apartment.
And everybody's got a gun. They all come out, and then the guns trade hands. It's just a really well done scene, though, too. It's a bit of action. There's great dialogue in it. The plot is really advanced. You find out again and go into this scene. Everybody's up to the top, and then you get Carmen showing up as well. So great scene.
Yeah,
I love him doing like a little hot potato with all the guns.
Then
he tells Carmen, "Get up! You look like a Pekingese."
Yeah. I loved when he was in the parking lot there, and he gets the gun from that guy. He has a line where he says, "Everyone keeps giving me guns." I laughed so hard. And then he does the thing with the little henchman guy, where he's like, "Oh, you're gonna need this," and he throws the gun on the ground. When he goes to get the gun, he just kicks him in the face. I'm like, That's one way to do it. Okay.
And then there's a couple of great lines. It's said a couple of times where someone's got a gun on somebody and they said, "What, you think I'm going to count to three like they do in the movies?"
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Little meta reference.
Yeah, it really is. It really is, man. And then, of course, I mentioned it earlier, but the ending, I think is so great because, you know, you've got, you know, them getting to this house before Eddie Mars gets there. And then, you know, they realize he's got his guys waiting outside. And so, and Marlowe just so brilliantly plays it so that he traps Eddie into going outside before him and his own men shoot him.
A lot.
And then he and Bacall are trapped in that house until the police get there. And that's a great final scene.
What a cool shot where Mars gets shot and you don't see any blood or anything like that. You just see the bullet holes show up on the wooden door. Mm-hmm. And it's just a really well done.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not even sure how they would have done that in 46, but it was just really well done scene there.
Yeah, it's so great. And we've talked about the look of the movie already, but the lighting and everything, the shadows and then the way that they'll shoot things from other people's points of view. It's really, really phenomenal. And really, I mean, it definitely has the classic look of noir. And I think it's, you know, a definitive, you know, entertaining crime story. Any other scenes before we move on?
No, I keep going back to that quote. There's no bad scenes.
Yeah.
There's not one.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I wanted to get to this. This movie has an interesting history, actually, because Bacall and Bogart have a huge hit with The Have and Have Not in 44. And then they go right into shooting this movie in late 44, early 45. But it's clear that World War II is coming to an end. And so Warner Brothers decides to put this movie on hold and get every other movie that they have in production that's war-themed rushed and out so that they're not irrelevant anymore once they're released, since Big Sleep doesn't really have any war references. Although, something I read, if you notice, like anyone who's driving a car, there's like a little B next to the gas gauges, which is which was a sign for gas rationing at the time. And then people also refer to rationing in the movies and stuff as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, but they wanted to rush all of the war themed films out. And so they stopped it. And in the meantime, Bacall makes a third movie called Confidential Agent with Charles Boyer. And it's released before this movie. And it is a huge flop. And her performance is panned. And so Hawks is panicking, saying, "We've invested so much in her. And was To Have and Have Not just a fluke?" And so her agent told Jack Warner, "What you need to do is go back into The Big Sleep." Because originally, the original cut of The Big Sleep did not have that famous scene in the restaurant where they talk about the horses. And then there were some other things that they changed. And they said, add some scenes like To Have and Have Not and make it crackle the way To Have and Have Not crackled.
Huh.
And so there are two, you know, we've talked about Godfather 3 and Spartacus, two movies with two cuts. This movie has two different cuts. There's a 45 cut and a 46 cut. And the 45 cut actually has a more linear story where it's easier to follow the crime, but the 46 release is just much more entertaining and has much more of the classic film noir elements. So the only people who ever got to see the 45 release were servicemen overseas, because they shipped the movie out early so guys overseas could watch it. And so both films exist, and I believe they both are on the Blu-ray, but the 46 scene I think is the much more famous one. But yeah, so Big Sleep was a hit thanks to the rewrites.
And it, I mean, they're not that different though, right? It's just a matter of adding a scene or two and then a shuffling.
There's 20 minutes of scenes that are different in both versions. So yeah, because they also changed Bacall's look. They said because Bacall was the older sister in the movie, they decided to put her in very matronly type wardrobe and stuff. So they changed her wardrobe in some of the scenes to make her look a lot more 40s chic as well. Yeah,
she is very glamorous in that restaurant scene.
She is.
That's like a metallic coat that she's got on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And so, yeah, and then, of course, the movie, when it was released, was a huge hit. did very well. And of course, Bogart and Bacall made two other movies together, Dark Passage and Key Largo, one right after the other. And they actually, in between when they originally shot the first cut of Big Sleep and then the scenes for the second cut, they got married. So during that restaurant scene, they were Mr. and Mrs. Bogart by that time. And so, remained married until his death in 1957. So yeah, a great ending for him to end up with someone like her. I think she kept him in line for that last decade of his life.
She's taller than him though, right? I mean, the way they shoot this movie,
she's very tall.
Yeah.
But the way they shoot this movie, he kind of has an inch or two on her, but I think there are probably scenes where they put her in flats or made him stand up on
a half apple. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, and they even in the script, they all say, what's one of the first things she said? You're not very tall, are you?
Yeah, that's what Carmen says to Philip Marlowe.
He says, well, I try to be. But yeah, so it's, let me see, the film earned $3.5 million domestically and $1.25 million foreign wise. So did very well for 1946 money. And then here was the New York Times review. The Big Sleep is one of those pictures in which so many cryptic things occur amid so much involved and devious plotting that the mind becomes utterly confused. And to make it more aggravating, the brilliant detective in the case is continuously making shrewd deductions, which he stubbornly keeps to himself. But with two interlocking mysteries and a great many characters involved, the complex of blackmail and murder soon become a web of utter bafflement. Unfortunately, the cunning scriptwriters have done little to clear it in the end. But it didn't matter because it was a huge hit, and people, I think over time people came to embrace the confusion of the plot, though, because it doesn't matter. It's like Whose Line Is It Anyway, with the points not mattering, the plot doesn't matter.
When I think it influences a lot of films that come after,
when we talked
to Eddie Muller, he mentioned the Coen brothers making noir-like movies. And when you look at something like The Big Lebowski, which has become sort of a cult classic, it's the same movie. I mean, it starts off with a man in a wheelchair kind of setting our main character off on this adventure, and the plot just doesn't matter. I mean, that movie kind of resolves the same way, where it just ends, but it's still really watchable. I mean, I think that's why that makes this movie a classic, is that it allows movies to not have the Hollywood ending.
Yeah. It's and that last shot is so great, with just the two of them looking, because normally they would embrace into like a kiss, but it's just the two of them staring at each other with the sirens in the background.
I love that choice.
It's so much more realistic. It doesn't put that button on it that I love that. It wouldn't fit with the tone of the film to have a big sweeping romantic ending like that.
No, absolutely not.
It would be weird in the mood after that, like, well, here's a dead guy, let's kiss.
And then, let's see, I'm looking at the accolades here. In 2003, the American Film Institute, on their greatest film heroes list, named Philip Marlowe the 32nd greatest hero in film history. And then in 1997, the Library of Congress added it to the National Film Registry. So, interesting, wasn't nominated for any Oscars, but I don't think film noir at the time was really looked at as a artistic genre. I think it's sort of the same as like Hitchcock was never really honored the way he should have been at the time.
But it's a
movie that really really made its mark. I think you can definitely see that in films that came after it. So Eric, we'll start the wrap up with you. Final thoughts on The Big Sleep?
So I think we have sort of identified this as, if not the definitive, one of the definitive film noir movies. The reason we got here is because we put up a Facebook poll and asked people to vote for what movie they wanted us to discuss. I think that tells you a lot about what this movie means to people and what it means to cinema culture and cinema history. And so for all those reasons, you'd want to go check it out. Once you get into it, though, there's not a bad scene. I think I had never heard that quote before, but it really resonates now. And it keeps you if not on the edge of your seat, at least very interested from start to finish. It's a fun movie to watch. It just drips with sexual chemistry too. The leads are impeccable. So it's a 5 out of 5 for me. Definitely go watch this movie.
Allison?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there is not a bad scene in this. They are exceptional. There's much more than 3 good scenes. There's really not a throwaway scene in it. Everything is happening for a reason, and it's quick, it's funny, it's challenging, it's engaging. It's a fantastic movie. Like, there is good reason why it has all the accolades that it has throughout its existence. And thank you, audience. Yeah. Because I don't know that I would have necessarily sat down and sought it out right now. Just, it's fantastic. And I'm really glad that I got a chance to watch it. And I think I'm going to have to watch it a few more times.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just because this one won doesn't mean that we won't do those other 3 in the future, because the other 3 that we had are fine movies as well. So yeah, but we, it just gives us more content to talk about. But okay. I think the reason this one did win is there's so much mythos surrounding Bacall and Bogart. And,
oh, yeah.
And there's so much love for them still to this day, just as a premier, you know, there's Tracy and Hepburn, the Starin Rogers and Bacall and Bogart. Those are the 3 mm-hmm. great, you know, film couples, although Starin Rogers weren't a couple in real life like the other 2 were. But when you think of those great screen couples who had great chemistry and just a lasting legacy, this is really it. And I think while I love all 4 of the movies that they made, and all 4 of them are special in their own way, I think this is their defining work. I think this is the one that most people think of, you know, aside, of course, To Have and Have Not has the famous, you know, how to whistle scene, mm-hmm. but I think this one overall is the better film. But yeah, it's a testament to the work of Raymond Chandler, because I don't think at the time mystery and pulp writers got the credit that they deserved, along with other novelists like Faulkner and Steinbeck and Fitzgerald. And I think you can put authors like Chandler and Hammett up with those guys, because the work that they did was superlative, and just the language that they used. I mean, every line in this, because I know that they took a lot of Chandler's language and put it in this movie, and it holds up, and it's beautiful. And so it's really, really fantastic. And film noir, you know, as a film movement, as Eddie said, didn't last very long, but it surely made its mark, because we're still talking about it and still using it today. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so I would totally, totally recommend it. So yeah, that closes out our month of November for here for Front Row Classics. Only one more month in the year of 2020. It's hard to believe.
Good riddance, 2020.
But Eric, do you want to give a preview of what we have coming up in December?
Oh, I'll try to remember everything, Brandon, but we've got a couple of different things. I know that we're going to be discussing not really a holiday picture, but has some holiday elements to it, and we wanted to go out on sort of a lighter note. So we're going to be discussing the movie Anti-Mame coming up in December, correct?
Yeah, that'll be the first one we do in December.
All right, so fill the people in on that one, because that fell out of my head.
Yeah. So we'll start with Anti-Mame in December, and I know Brett Rutherford wants to be on that one, so he's going to join us. And then finally, in late December, we're going to get Jeremy back on for the first time in a while, and we're going to talk about one of his favorite movies, The Great Race, from 1965, with Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis and Natalie Wood. So we've had a couple of months of talking about heavier stuff, and I thought let's go out with December and talk about some funny stuff. So so you can look forward to that. And then also Eric and I joined Lou on Guilty Pleasures last month. Earlier this month. It feels like last month, but we talked about The Godfather 3. But I think if we all three of us are able to see the new Coppola cut that comes out in December, we'll all join back together and see if it's any better.
Well, hearing that The Big Sleep got recut and became a better movie gives me some hope, because I think I made a point that most of the movies that do get recut don't come out better than they were before. It's tough to take a movie that people generally consider like maybe a C or a B grade and turn it into an A. So we'll see.
So we'll see. But a good way to close out December, and then hopefully we'll just go into 2021 with even more content, and hopefully be able to get out a little more than we were to this year. But it's been great. So once again, as always, you can find us on Facebook. We have an Instagram page. I think because the poll was successful, I think Eric will probably do another one next year at some point. So just a lot of good chance to let the audience chime in. And then also find us on Patreon if you feel like supporting us and the work that we do and make it possible for us to give even more content. That would be great. So we will finish the year out strong. So as we close out this month's Front Row Classics, I'm Brandon Davis.
I'm Eric Flick.
I'm Allison Means.
And we will see you in the front row.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening to this episode, a proud member of the Front Row Network of shows on NPR Illinois. For the past 5 years, we've been providing hours of content every month, and now we've created the chance for all of you to get even more content. We've officially launched our Patreon page to give you the chance to support our work. There are 4 separate levels, and each come with their own amazing bonus perks, including exclusive episodes, full movie commentary tracks, and even the ability to choose what episodes we do and be on them with us. To show your support, simply go to www.patreon.com/frontrownetwork. That's patreon.com/frontrownetwork. Thank you again, and as always, we'll see you in the front row.